Hey, everybody. Very quick intro to today's show. Eric and I, we did speak about Edwin Diaz and how excited we were for the season. And on Wednesday night, Edwin Diaz was injured, celebrating Puerto Rico's win over the Dominican Republic in the World Baseball Classic. It is currently 5:45 a.m. on Thursday. We have had no formal diagnosis on Diaz's knee, but again, things don't look good. So we will provide updates either at the Apple or our next episode here on Simply Amazing. But just a heads up, today's episode is prior to Diaz's injury, and we'll keep you guys posted. We know what you know. Hang tight. Here comes the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's another episode of Simply Amazing. Due to work and teaching constraints, Taryn is not with us this week. So everybody, if you see Taryn on Twitter, say you missed him. Tell him that we need him back ASAP, because he's become my better half. But you know, as a very, very strong consolation prize, my buddy and your friend, I'm sure you've read his stuff on Twitter, and whether you've seen it elsewhere, we'll get into all that. But author of, oh boy, over a half dozen books, and a good friend, Eric Sherman. Eric, really welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, the pleasure is all mine, Tim. Thanks so much for having me on today.
Oh, not a problem, man. It's I was very lucky to be on the same panel as you at the Queens Baseball Convention this year, and we talked about it that day. I said, "Oh, we have to make this happen." And boy, with the new book coming out and with opening day right around the corner, two weeks away, friends. If you're going to be listening to this on Thursday, so yeah, we're right around the corner. It's today. I think right now would be a good time to get that wheel rolling.
Yeah, absolutely. And just can't wait for the baseball season to start.
Oh, my goodness. I think everyone's waiting on the edge of their seats for this season. I mean, Mets fans included, of course, because everything is very, very exciting for Mets fans these days. But I think just the hope springs eternal of baseball season, whether it's the players, the fans, and I mean, you're even seeing it with the World Baseball Classic. I think you're kind of infusing the game with this, you know, very unique energy at such an early point in the year. It should be really fun to get things started once the regular season kicks off.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the World Baseball Classic, I've never seen that ballpark in Miami more electric than it's been over the last week or so. It's just unbelievable. First of all, yeah, I mean, you know, you never see it full. You know, you never see a sellout like you're seeing now, and the fans are just going crazy at every pitch. And so, but with the World Baseball Classic, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. I think it was Scherzer the other day that was saying that, you know, he was a little bit critical of it because of the effect that it might have on starting pitchers. You know, starting pitchers this time of year, they really shouldn't be letting loose like they are in this tournament, and it can induce injuries, and it's a little bit risky. But listen, anything that will, you know, bring out the fans and the excitement of the game, I think ultimately it's a good thing. But I certainly understand Scherzer's point.
Oh, absolutely. And I think he made another point regarding possibly shifting this to another part of the season. And I think we've seen the NHL do it when the Olympics come around, where you take a 2-week break or what have you. And you know, you fill it in with a league-wide or a worldwide tournament, I should say. And, you know, you have guys who are fresh. You have guys who are playing at their absolute best, you know, not 2 weeks into spring training, where, you know, we're familiar as baseball fans where our players are at this point in the year. And you know, whether that, I'm sure that takes, you know, at least, you know, some dedicated time to prepping themselves for, you know, a high stakes tournament in the middle of March.
Yeah, I would wait actually until the end of the year. I think even if you do it in the middle of the season, you know, you risk injury to some really key players and it can affect pennant races. I would wait till the end of the year, you know, after the World Series ends. To me, that would make the most sense. Because right now I think the pitchers, really have to go slowly into the season. So anyway, like I said, if it brings excitement to the game, that, you know, that's a good thing.
Shifting from the World Baseball Classic to the, to spring training, any thoughts on the pitch clock so far? The enlarged bases, the new rules, I should say.
Well, I like the pitch clock a lot. It's just necessary. The game is dragging. We're living in a TikTok age now where, you know, things have to move along quickly. And if you look at the other sports, they all move much, much quicker than baseball games did. But, you know, honestly, Tim, you know, the pace of these games with the pitch clock, all it's doing really is it's taking us back to when we were kids, you know, when we were watching games, well, at least for me, back in the 70s and the 80s. And, I'll never forget. And I tell the story all the time. The first game I ever saw in the new Yankee Stadium, back in 1976, Catfish Hunter was pitching against the Red Sox. Yankees won the game 1-0. The game went 10 innings. Catfish Hunter pitched all 10 innings. Time of game was 2 hours, 16 minutes. And if you look at any, you know, you can look at YouTube or anything like that, and you watch the pace that a guy like Catfish Hunter, who was pretty exemplary of his day with his pace, I mean, he didn't wander off the pitching, you know, too far away from the pitching rubber. He just got the ball, got the sign and pitched. And so I think we're going to be going back to that. And I think it's a really, really healthy thing for the game. And they're working out kinks in spring training, and that's what spring training's for. Now, bigger bases. I was out in Arizona a couple of weeks ago. I couldn't tell the difference from, you know, from the stands. I can't tell the difference when watching TV. If it's safer for the base runners, it's fine. You know, the old timers will say it's ridiculous. That second baseman need to learn how to properly get out of the way of an ensuing base runner. That there's an art to that. But hey, I mean, I think that's minor.
The bases thing, I think it's going to be very, very subtle, but I think it's going to increase offense. Cause you know, baseball is a game of inches, and whether that, you know, 90 feet is a perfect size. I know that the distance is still going to be 90 feet on bases, but you know, just whether it's going to result in someone getting to the bag a little bit quicker or whatever, what have you, someone, you know, reaching swiping a base a little bit easier. They're going to be very subtle changes. But again, I think it's all going to lead to a faster paced, higher offense game, which, you know, and this is kind of encompasses the pitch clock as well. Is it maybe too much, too fast for some fans, some players? I mean, I've heard points being very well made that the Players Association, you know, was against a pitch clock. They were okay with the bases, I believe, but
oh sure,
they only had a committee of a three-person committee on a 12 three-person panel on a 12-person committee. So, you know, this cards were stacked against them to begin with. I'm very curious as to where this all heads. I'm very curious as to if they did too much a little bit too quickly, but you know, kind of ringing to what you were saying about Catfish Hunter, I had the absolute pleasure of speaking to Randy Jones, who's recovering from some health stuff right now. We wish Randy the best. This is going back a few years now, but he spoke in detail about an hour, 29-minute complete game, well, nine-inning game, him versus Jim Cott in 1977, which I believe still stands as a major league record. You know, if Major League Baseball is trying to get things down to the 3-hour mark on average, or under the 3 hour mark on average, that would be great, because the Mets played, you know, over a dozen games of over 3.5 hours, 9-inning games last year. And that's just, you know, that's too much for some people. I mean, I have to be up early for work. That's too much for me. But, you know, you get to a certain point. But yeah, I'm curious to see how it all shakes out. I'm curious to see if it sticks. If baseball said maybe we did too much here.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, with the shift, that'll increase offense. But I think the pitch clock, another thing it's going to do is it'll improve defense, because the, you know, the fielders, they'll be ready, you know, like they won't be just standing around, like they'll be in position and they'll be ready. And I think defenses typically feel better when the pitcher works quickly, and it's going to keep them on their toes. And so I just think it's going to be a better game. But boy, when I was at a couple of spring training games, it was amazing how much quicker the game goes. I mean, you know, you're barely finishing your chicken nuggets and the game is over, you know.
Hey, you know, I think that's probably also got to be taken into consideration, is how, you know, teams feel and stadiums feel about, hey, we're shortening up our game. We have to, I guess, kind of adjust as well. And yeah, I think it's going to be a multi-layered process, but I do agree with you. It's good for the game. It's going to result in a more potent form of this game that we love. And yeah, I think that, combined with the general excitement of what's going on with our Mets right now, I think everything can kind of be summed up as wow. Now, Eric, you have a very innate knowledge and history with pretty much everything New York Mets. I mean, starting with you wrote a book with Davey Johnson that's called My Wild Ride. My Wild Ride in Baseball and Beyond. You wrote a book with Art Shamsky, of course, member of the 1969 Miracle Mets, called After the Miracle. It's a lasting brotherhood of the 69 Mets, which, by the way, I bought that from my mom and she loved it, Eric. Loved it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And of course, Kings of Queens, which is the story of the 86 Mets by Eric Sherman. And not to be outdone, we actually have the other side of the 86 Mets. It's the two sides of glory. It's a story of the 86 World Series, of the 86 season from the Red Sox point of view, which I really enjoyed. But Eric, have you experienced?
And don't forget about Mookie.
Mookie. My apologies, and Mookie. I had to scroll my page down. Now, you, of course, like as I was saying, you have such a deep knowledge of this organization, this franchise, you know, some of the just cornerstone players and pieces of very, you know, the highest peaks of this franchise. And of course, your time as a fan as well. Have you seen such an excitement generated around the New York Mets as you're seeing right now?
Well, I think there was a tremendous amount of excitement going into 85. Because what happened, you know, as you well know, Tim, the Mets, from the time they traded Seaver and Kingman mid-season in 77 through 83, I mean, they were a really, you know, awful baseball team. I mean, they weren't just a bad team, but they were boring. And, you know, when fans would go to Shea Stadium back then, I mean, certainly you had some exciting players. You know, you had Lenny Randle, and who was really a terrific all-around player, underrated in my book, Lee Mazzilli, Craig Swan. But you had a lot of guys that, you know, everyday players that would hit, you know, 235, 240. You know, they were good for maybe 8 or 9 home runs. And you know, the pitching wasn't bad, but there was, you know, without Seaver and Kuzman and Madelak anymore, you know, they were just okay. Not a lot of excitement. Then all of a sudden, 84 comes out of nowhere, where they go from, you know, being a perennial cellar dweller team for 7 years to winning 90 games. And that was Davey Johnson's first year as manager. It was Daryl Strawberry's first full season with the team. Dwight Gooden's first year. Keith Hernandez, that was his first season, first full season. So they shocked everyone. In fact, I remember the summer of 84 thinking, this is what 1969 must have felt like. I was only 3 years old then, but I'm thinking this is what it must have felt like. And so they, take the Cubs right down to the wire. I think it was the most fun Mets fans have ever had, 84. And that includes 86, by the way, because it was so unexpected. Now, after 84, they go out and they acquire through a trade Gary Carter, who was, without question, the best catcher in the game, one of the best catchers of all time. And they add him to that team that they already had that won 90 games. And to me, entering a season, there was never more fervor and anticipation than 85. Of course, they just barely lost in 85, but they won, 98 games. Then 86, going into that season, there was a sense, even from the top with Davey, saying, we're not just going to win, we're going to dominate. And that's when they added some subtle pieces, like Bobby Ojeda. They got him from the Red Sox for Calvin Chiraldi. And Ojeda had pretty much been the model of mediocrity with the Red Sox, as far as, win-loss record. And then he comes to the Mets and he's the ace of the staff in 86. Tim Tuffel was another subtle pickup because, Backman was an excellent left-handed hitter, but from the right side, not nearly as good. So they pick up Tuffel. 85, 86, but really 85, I think even more so than this season. This season, Tim, the Mets, they're going to be in the toughest division in baseball. The Phillies have really improved on a pennant winning team with some of their additions. The Braves are just, all their players are in their prime right now. That's going to be a tough division. And really what the Mets did, they made some solid acquisitions, but people don't talk enough about Verlander and how if Verlander can pitch an entire season injury free, that's a huge upgrade over DeGrom. And I love DeGrom, but he just had so many injuries over the last three seasons. And I think they got six wins out of him last year or something like that. If Verlander can go out and win, 18, moving into DeGrom's spot, the Mets might win 105 games, so we'll see. The division's tough. Even the Marlins are better. So,
I think the Nationals are going to be a tough team. I really do.
Really?
I think that's just, it's a super talented, very, very young team. Don't get me wrong, they're a few years away from actually contending, but boy, there are going to be some tough series against Washington, against Florida. I still call them Florida. My mistake. Against Miami. I think it's going to be a very tough division. A tip of the cap to the Mets for going out and pivoting so smoothly to say, all right, we just lost a franchise player in DeGrom. What do we do? Boom, we're getting Justin Verlander. And, tying him up with Max. You have two, not just, co-aces, you have two future inner circle Hall of Famers. You're leading your rotation and just the leadership that's going to kind of trickle down from those two throughout the rest of the rotation. You got Carrasco in there. You got two young guys in McGill and Peterson. The news with Quintana is very concerning. All the best to Jose Quintana. That's scary stuff. What started with a stress fracture is turned into a lesion on his rib, and nothing cancerous, but it's gonna be a bone graft surgery. He's out till July. All the best to him, but man, shame on me for saying that that the Mets should have been entertaining trades for David Peterson this offseason, because it looks like they're gonna need him.
Oh, absolutely. They're going to need Peterson. They're going to need all hands on deck. With a Scherzer and a Verlander, you're going to have to spell them every once in a while. Sure. I would like to have seen them pick up another hitter, another bat, but we'll see. They have a nice mix of young players and veterans, and I think they're going to be really good. I think the Mets will win 95 to 100 games, and it's just on the strength of the division, and I think they have some age in their pitching, it would be difficult to expect Diaz to be as brilliant out of the bullpen this year. He was a Cy Young candidate last year. He was
got Cy Young and a couple of MVP votes, or possibly one MVP vote.
He should have. He was remarkable, and it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. I remember you mentioned earlier about my book on the 69 Mets that I did with Art after the miracle. I remember being in the car or a van that I rented, and it was such a great moment. We were driving up to see Seaver at his vineyard and home in Calistoga, California. And
this is after the miracle, correct?
After the miracle, yep. Yeah. And, I had Kuzman riding shotgun, and I had Shamsky, Swoboda, and Harrelson in the back. And I remember we talked about Diaz, and, this would have been 2017. And he was just getting it. Diaz was just getting hit so hard, and I remember Kuzman telling me he hoped that the Mets wouldn't give up on that kid, he said, because he has electric stuff and it just needs to be harnessed, and someone like Kuzman remembers another flamethrower like Nolan Ryan. Sometimes it takes time. It took Randy Johnson time. It took Sandy Koufax time. So hopefully Diaz has found it. And he's harnessed, because if he has, he's the best reliever in baseball.
Oh, absolutely. He's certainly, it's very tough to put him up there with Mo Rivera, but in recent memory, who's been that dominant just so consistently? And like you said, the evolution of him as a player and shaking off the rust and finding himself. And you almost watch that confidence build from outing to outing, from month to month, from year to year. And look at, he's just turned into a machine. It's so impressive. Eric, we're going to take a real quick break just to hear from our sponsors. We're going to come right back. All right.
Great.
Excellent. Everybody hang tight.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
And we are back with Eric Sherman, author of, Eric, I'm going to do it again.
I'll give you the number. So I have 8 books out there and I'm working on my 9th right now.
Nice. And now you got Daybreak at Chavez Ravine, the story of Fernando Valenzuela coming out, right? Or it's out now?
Well, you can order it through Amazon, but the official release date is May 1st. But yeah, if you use Amazon, you can get it in, I think, a couple of days now.
What is this newfangled invention called Amazon?
It's just incredible. You know, they had the books were printed early and and Amazon fulfilled all their orders, their pre-orders. So you can get through them. But if you want to, you know, support your local bookstores, then just hold out till May 1st on that. And so real quick, Daybreak at Chavez Ravine, Fernando Mania and the remaking of the Los Angeles Dodgers. It's more or less on the impact of Fernando that he had, not just on baseball, but more specifically on the Mexican-American community, and not just in Los Angeles, but around the world, the effect he had on Latinos. But, you know, Dodger Stadium was built in Chavez Ravine, where it sits today. And before Dodger Stadium, there were 3 neighborhoods comprised mostly of Mexican-Americans. And that land was owned by the city, and originally it was earmarked for affordable housing. But in the early 50s with the Red Scare, affordable housing was deemed to be socialist. So the city was stuck with 300 acres of prime real estate, and they lured the Dodgers to leave New York and to go out there. But some of the residents of Chavez Ravine we're like, hey, you know, we don't want to sell, or if we do sell to the city, then we want what our homes are worth, you know, not 50 cents on the dollar like a lot of the other sellers were getting. Some of them literally, because it was that land was seized through eminent domain, some of those residents were literally dragged from their homes and watched as their homes, some of them, they had owned those homes for 3 generations, watched them get bulldozed right before their very eyes. And so it was an awful, awful visual and reality for these people and, you know, for Mexican Americans. So they were not Dodger fans until Fernando came along and set the world on fire in 1981. And Dodger Stadium went from having 5% Mexican Americans and Latinos to having 50%, especially on games that he pitched. And if you go to Dodger Stadium today, those numbers are pretty similar.
I was going to say, it's really reverberated. I mean, you know, the Latino presence at a Dodger game is felt. It's loud. It energizes the stadium. It's woven into the fabric of Dodger Stadium, and it makes it one of the most, you know, unique and just wonderful places in the game.
Yeah, and you'll see more Fernando throwback jerseys than you will most of their current players. I interviewed nearly 100 people in Fernando's inner circle and outside of his inner circle. I think fans of Fernando are going to learn an awful lot about not just him, but his impact that he had on the game, which I would put him on the Mount Rushmore of most impactful baseball people associated with the game. I say people instead of players because I put Marvin Miller on that Mount Rushmore, right, along with Babe Ruth and Jackie Robinson. And I honestly would put Fernando right there with those three.
Now, in the sense of what he did on the field or what he did off the field, or a combination of both?
Oh, I think on the field. You know, he's
revolutionary in some senses.
Yeah. I mean, he's an intensely private person, which is why I didn't interview him for this book. Mm-hmm. But that's part of his charm, and it plays a big role in this book. I mean, this is a guy that turns down offers to sign autographs for a couple of hours at a card show that would pay him in excess of $40,000. For mm-hmm. 2 hours work. Oh, yeah. Because he just doesn't want to be amongst the masses. He's very private. Ironically, he's one of the Spanish language analysts, but he leaves games in the seventh inning, you know, to avoid people. So it's part of the story. He's just an intensely private individual. But when you talk about his impact, he was in the game for, I think, 8 weeks at the time. And, he started off, he threw six shutouts and I think his first eight starts. And he gets invited to the White House and to a luncheon with the Mexican president who was in town to meet with President Reagan. They call it the Fernando factor, that following that lunch, that legislation was passed to give, to lead the way from Mexican Americans to get their citizenship in this country. And so when you do talk about his impact, it wasn't just on the field, but it was off the field as well.
You're right. Sure. I mean, if you look before Fernando, I mean, for upper crust Latin American starting pitchers or Latino starting pitchers, you had your Juan Marichals, you had, few and far between almost, but then, you look forward and look at the impacts that they, look at maybe Denny Martinez had, in pitching. And now, even today, how the game has grown. I would, I know he wasn't the first or the last, but I would certainly put him up on the list of people who continued that trajectory of growing the sport and mainstreaming the greatest players of each of these, very, very small baseball wild countries. Of course, Mexico's a large country, but that spread to, it's such a big game in Puerto Rico. It's a huge game in the Dominican Republic. It reverberated, at least in my mind. And I think that, at least in its place in time, I think that play of Fernando's, ascension and peak probably played a very, very big part in the next generation of young Latino players.
Yeah.
Putting all their eggs into the baseball basket.
Yeah. I think it helped me. Well, you never had scouts actively looking for players in Mexico before Fernando. But globally though, he opened up the doors to the Hideo Nomos of the world from Japan.
Oh, sure. Looking at, this is 1983, and before Fernando, I looked back a few years, there weren't many Latino pitchers in NL Cy Young voting. In the years after, and this is in 1980, as I said, 1982, my apologies.
Uh-huh.
Just in the top nine, you had Fernando Valenzuela, Joaquin Andujar, and Mario Soto.
Joaquin Andujar?
You have guys who are probably getting a few more eyes on them and a little bit more confidence going out there. And I think that you probably saw ripple effects right away.
You really did. Yeah. And And not just with Latino players, like I said, you know, in Asia and elsewhere. And he opened the doors where, you know, teams were like, you know, we should really look harder beyond the U.S. for players. And so, yeah, he had an effect on all of baseball. But he is an absolute legend with the Latino and particularly the Mexican-American community.
Well, I am getting my ducks in a row, and I'm going to go ahead and get my Amazon one, my pre-order bought, and I'm also going to hit my bookstore because I love my local bookstore, and I'm going to hit that on May 1st. But good. I am really looking forward to it, Eric. I can't wait.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Any plans for the season? Any projects you're working on for the upcoming 2023 season?
Well, I absolutely am. I mean, I'll be in Los Angeles the first week of the Fernando book release. So I'll be doing media out there and book signings. So if anybody, and if any of your listeners are out in Los Angeles, you know, you can follow me on Twitter at by Eric Sherman. And I always give details on where I'm going to be through Twitter or ericshermanbaseball.com. I'm working on a new book project now with Dwight Evans.
Nice.
And, you know, everybody knows Dwight is one of the greatest Red Sox of all time. He's in the top three offensive categories with the team in almost everything. And he was one of the greatest defensive right fielders of all time with just a rifle of an arm, and really an underrated player in my book. I believe he should be in the Hall of Fame. I hope he still gets there. But there was something else at work, which a lot of people don't know about. He had, you know, he was playing at the top of his game while parenting and taking care of two sons that suffered from NF, which is commonly referred to as elephant man's disease. And they both recently passed away. But they both had over 40 surgeries each. And so while he was playing at such a high level, he was caring for these two boys, of course, along with his wife, Susan, and many sleepless nights coming straight from the hospital to the ballpark. And so he's just an extraordinary man of strength that he was able to play under those circumstances as well as he did. So this is going to be it kind of keeps with all the books that I've done. My books.
I can say it's baseball. The intersection of life and baseball, Eric. And that's really what I love about your books.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, that's exactly it. It's, you know, my stories are more human interest, and they go well beyond the game and into real life challenges.
That's the beauty of it, because this is what baseball teaches us. It teaches us that, oh, it's not always going to be, you know, 10 run blowouts going in your direction. It's going to be coming the other way too. And, you know, it's a game of adjustments, and that's life and baseball. Eric, I can't thank you enough for spending some time, man. I wish we had another half hour to go.
Well, I'm happy to come back anytime, Tim. You know that.
Excellent, man. Well, best of luck to you with the new book, with the ongoing projects, and we'll have to do this again sometime soon.
Sounds good, Tim.
All right, everybody, Eric Sherman, at Eric Sherman on Twitter. Let me make sure I had that correct.
It's at by Eric Sherman. I'm
at by Eric Sherman. My apologies.
No.
About like a 99% perfect show, and then he slipped.
No, you know, I believe it or not, there's another author named Eric Sherman who also spells his name with a K, and he's a terrific guy, very talented writer, but he has the at Eric Sherman. So I am at by. Eric Sherman on Twitter. So
it's Eric with a K, folks.
Thank you, Tim. Yeah, that's right.
Not a problem. Eric, can't wait to do it again. Again, best of luck with everything. We'll help plug the book when it comes out. And everybody, we'll be back very soon, definitely with another update before opening day. And you guys know the sign off. It's Let's Fucking Go Mets. We'll see you next time. Peace.